There's a question here. What can I do to preserve the first jhana overnight? Jhanas are impermanent. They can't be preserved. All that you can do really is learn how to access them. And then you access them and your mind is very concentrated, and then you do insight practice and they fade away. And then you repeat. But yeah, there's no way to preserve them. And the first jhana, actually, if you were to preserve that with all that piti and sukha going, you won't sleep. So another announcement. We finished the first round of interviews. And we're just going to use the same interview sheet. So you will have an interview at the same time, 3 days after your first interview. So if you had an interview on Saturday, you'll have it tomorrow at the same time. Sunday, day after tomorrow, and if you had one today, it'll be in 3 days. Any questions about that? Okay. So tonight, I want to talk about the first four jhanas. The description of the jhanas in the gradual training occurs after the abandoning of the hindrances. And so I'll read you what it says. Quite secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and remains in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining, and is filled with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. One drinks deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. Okay, so the secluded from sense pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, refers to the abandoning of the hindrances. When you generate access concentration, that is, you're fully with the object of meditation, and any thoughts are wisping in the background and not pulling you into distraction, you have abandoned the hindrances, right? Because any hindrance is going to be a distraction. You're going to be wanting, and that's a distraction, or you're averse, and that's a distraction. So by generating access concentration, you have abandoned the hindrances, and you are secluded. So one enters and remains in the first jhana, which is accompanied by, well, the Pali words are vitaka and vichara. They're often translated as initial and sustained attention to the meditation object. But that's a later understanding. To the Buddha, the words vitaka and vichara just meant thinking and examining, or thinking and pondering, or probably thinking and more thinking. Notice down here we have one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses. Pali frequently, in order to add emphasis, uses a bunch of similar words in a row. And I think that's what's going on here. Basically, what this is saying is that when you're in the first jhana, your concentration is not so strong that you have completely stopped the background thinking, that wispy background thinking that you experience at access concentration is still there in the first jhana. The understanding of vitaka and vichara as initial and sustained attention shows up in the Abhidhamma, so a couple hundred years after the Buddha's death. And then it says this jhana is filled with rapture and happiness born of seclusion, or piti and sukha. The common translation for piti is rapture, and for sukha, you see joy or happiness. The best translation of piti that I've come across is glee, a sort of excited pleasure, an excited physical pleasure. The entry into the first jhana can have preceding it one of any of the five kinds of piti that are talked about in the commentaries. There's minor piti, and that could show up as rocking, right? Just a little energy there, swaying, something like that. Sort of a low-grade tinkling. Then there's momentary PT, and that would be like a shiver running through you. There's showering PT, and that's when the PT shivers come and go away and then come back and go away, but they don't sustain. There's uplifting PT. That's the PT that makes you sit up very straight, makes your hair stand on end, a sense of energy going upwards that many people report. And then there's what's called all-pervasive PT, or full-blown PT. So that's PT that has arisen and is sustaining, and that's what you're after for the first jhana. And then there is sukha, happiness or joy, the emotional component of the PT sukha experience. As I said earlier, when you first start entering the first jhana, you may not be able to distinguish between what's the physical component, what's the emotional component. It's just the PT sukha component. But as you get more skilled, then you can begin to tell the difference. Now it says, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. When the first jhana comes on, a lot of people find that it's more the upper torso and head and maybe the spine. Right? So you've got energy going, but it's not the whole body. Spreading it throughout the whole body is an advanced practice. The first thing you want to learn is get to the first jhana the first time. And then the next thing is get back to the first jhana and figure out how to get there on a regular basis. And then figure out how, when you get there, you can sustain the experience. The length of time you want to sustain it is inversely proportional to the intensity of the experience. So if the PT and sukha come on and it's kind of mild, you know, you've got this energy and it's kind of happy and it's nice, then you could stay there 5 to 10 minutes. But sometimes it comes on very intensely, like finger in the light socket intense. And if that happens, you might not want to stay so long. But while it's there, once you've gotten so that you can bring it on and sustain it, then you want to try and spread it through your whole body. And the way to do that is to put your attention where it seems to be the strongest, and then sort of sweep your attention down into the parts where it's not there. And then just sort of come back. Notice, did the PT sukha seem to move? And if it did, then move your attention into some other part. And did the PT sukha seem to move? And then through the rest of the torso and down the legs all the way to the feet. It's not a difficult thing to learn, but you want to first get good at getting in and then good at sustaining the PT sukha experience once you're in. And then when you can sustain it, then you can try moving it through your whole body. We have a simile. Suppose a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice were to pour soap flakes into a metal basin, sprinkle them with water, and knead them into a ball so that the ball of soap flakes would be pervaded by moisture, encompassed by moisture, suffused with moisture inside and out, and yet would not trickle. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. So we have a picture of what life was like at the time of the Buddha. You didn't go to the store and buy a bar of soap. You got your skilled bath attendant to get a metal bowl and pour in soap flakes and pour in water and then mix the soap flakes and water until he had a homogeneous ball of soap. This is actually quite a good depiction of the energetic feel of the first jhana. When you're in the jhana, it's kind of frenetic, like mixing the soap flakes in the water. Okay? when you've got it going really well, the water permeates all of the soap flakes and the Piti Sukha permeates all of your entire body. So yeah, a pretty accurate simile here. As I said, the intensity of the jhana is more or less what determines how long you want to stay in it. If it's not so intense, yeah, you can stay 5-10 minutes, but if it's too intense, you're going to want to get out of it fairly quickly. The thing to do when you've had enough of the first jhana, either you've been there long enough or it's just like, wow, this is too much, I want to move on, is take a nice deep breath and really let the energy out as you exhale. Remember I said that when you were working to get to the first jhana and your breath gets very shallow, don't take a deep breath. It takes you away from the first jhana. But now that you've managed to get to the first jhana and you want to go away from the first jhana, take that deep breath and really let the energy out. In the first jhana, the piti, which is the physical component, predominates, and the sukha, which is the emotional component, is more in the background. When you take that deep breath, they both come down in intensity, but the physical comes down more, and now the emotional is predominating and the physical's in the background. Put your attention on the emotional sense of joy, happiness. When you do, it'll come back up a bit in intensity, and that becomes the focus for the second jhana. The piti remains in the background, okay, but it's not so intense anymore. Instead of it being perhaps finger in the electrical socket, you might find yourself rocking or swaying or there's a little buzzy feeling or something like that. The description of the second jhana. Further, with the subsiding of thinking and examining, one enters and remains in the second jhana, which is accompanied by inner tranquility and unification of mind, and is without thinking and examining, and is filled with rapture and happiness born of concentration. One drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so that there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. Okay, so when you take that deep breath and calm the piti down, what's also going on, hopefully, is that you're generating inner tranquility. The word tranquil doesn't really apply to the piti experience. It's a pretty active and frenetic experience. But when you take that breath and let the energy out, then a sense of tranquility comes in, both physically and mentally. When you're in the first jhana, there's a bit of agitation in the mind. And now when you calm things down by really exhaling, the mind calms down, the piti calms down, the sukha calms down, and now you put your attention on the sukha. The thinking and examining falls away and is replaced by unification of mind. In the first jhana, there's still those background thoughts. Ideally, in the second jhana, as things calm down, your mind really collects on the experience of sukha with background piti, and your mind becomes unified around that experience. Ideally, there would be no thinking, no thoughts. You're concentrated enough that you just don't think. On a short retreat like this, you're not likely to generate the depth of concentration so that you completely shut off the thoughts. But they should be further in the background, and you're really focused in, really giving yourself fully to the experience of the sukha. Technically, what's going on, if this is the sukha and this is your one-pointedness, you're focused on the sukha and you start to lose it and get back. This little thought creeps in and you're back. So you're starting to fall out of the jhana. It's not so stable. Ideally, you're there and you just don't think. But as I say, it'll probably wobble a bit. it takes really deeper concentration to get to the point where the thoughts just aren't happening in the second jhana. Again, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this rapture and happiness born of concentration, so that there is no part of one's body not filled with this rapture and happiness. Again, the sukha may seem to be localized. If the first jhana seems to be happening more around the face, then the second one will probably be centered more around the heart center, or perhaps even lower in the belly. There's this sense of things dropping down. But when you've made that transition, it may be just the torso that's feeling like the sukha with the background PT, the torso and the head. Again, put your attention where the sukha feels the strongest. Sweep it down into the other places where it doesn't seem to be. And if you do that nice and slowly over a minute or two, then the sukha will seem to completely fill your whole being. We have a simile. Suppose there were a deep lake whose waters welled up from below. It would have no inlet for water from the east, west, north, or south, nor would it be refilled from time to time with showers of rain. And yet a current of cool water welling up from within the lake would drench deep, saturate, and suffuse the whole lake, so that there would be no part of that entire lake which is not suffused with the cool water. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused with this rapture and happiness. So the picture is of a lake up in the mountains. There's no streams coming in, there's no rain, but there's a spring at the bottom of the lake. And the cool water from the spring totally permeates the lake, totally fills the lake. This is an amazingly accurate simile for the feeling of the second jhana. I had been practicing the second jhana for a little over a year when I first heard this simile. And after Ayakema finished her talk, I went running up to her and, Aya, it's just like that. Because this really does capture the feeling. There's just this upwelling of joy, upwelling of happiness. It just keeps going. And you're focused on that sense of happiness, of joy. Again, you want to get skilled at getting to the second jhana and sustaining the second jhana, and then as an advanced practice, spreading the second jhana through your being. And you want to be able to hang out there for, let's say 10 to 15 minutes. Your sense of time is distorted, but you want to be able to keep it for a while. After you've been able to sustain it for an extended period, then you can move on to the third jhana. Further, with the fading away of rapture, one dwells in equanimity, mindful and clearly comprehending, and experiences happiness with the body. Thus one enters and remains in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, one dwells happily with equanimity and mindfulness. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this happiness free from rapture, so that there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this happiness. Okay, the first thing to notice is the fading away of the piti. Right? In the first jhana, the piti predominates. In the second jhana, it's still there, but in the background. And now, the third jhana, it's gone. And all that's left is sukha. But the sukha is quieter. The sukha is really transformed from joy, happiness, to contentment, to a state of wishlessness, to a deep state of satisfaction. Satisfaction so complete that if Mick Jagger had been practicing the third jhana, he wouldn't be able to sing that song. Okay? Total satisfaction. The way to get there is, once again, you can take a deep breath and let the energy out. It might be helpful to remember a time when you were very contented. You just eaten the perfect meal, you didn't overeat, and you don't have to wash the dishes. You know, it's just like, right? A quarter second long memory, pluck the feeling of contentment out of it. And now as you're exhaling and letting the energy subside, let the sukha, the happiness, joy, go towards that feeling of contentment. And then let your mind lock into that feeling of contentment. You'll know it's the third jhana because there's still the sukha, but there's no piti. If you get to contentment and there's still piti left, you're still in the second jhana. It's a lower level of the second jhana, right? But if it's got piti there, it can't be the third jhana. So basically, you're in the second, you take a nice deep breath, you let the energy out, you remember a time when you were contented, you pluck the feeling of contentment out, and as the sukha energy decreases, it becomes that feeling of contentment. And now your object of attention is contentment. So in the first jhana, your focus is on the piti sukha. In the second, it's on the sukha with background piti. And now it's on sukha manifesting as contentment. So the objects are changing and getting more subtle as we go along. In fact, the eight jhanas are arranged in increasing subtlety of object. The higher the number, the more subtle the object. You should have given up attention on the breathing back when you switched to the pleasant sensation in order to enter the first jhana, right? You were focused on the pleasant sensation, and then the piti and sukha comes, and now you're focused on the piti and sukha. You take the breath, calm to the sukha with background piti for the second, no attention on the breathing. And that can be hard, because you've been trying so hard to be concentrated enough to notice the breathing, and now you're concentrated enough, and I'm saying don't notice the breathing. But just really give yourself to the sukha. And then another breath, and you're down to the feeling of contentment, which is the object. So again, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body. By putting the attention on wherever that contentment is, probably lower feeling than where the happiness was, and then spreading the attention throughout the body, just gently moving it. You're not trying to move the contentment. You put your attention on the contentment and then just move your attention. And the contentment usually follows along. The sense of going down as the numbers go up is very strong. It's so strong if somebody says, I was in the second jhana and then I went up. I don't know whether they meant numerically up to the first or numerically up to the third, which is physically down, or physically up to the first, which is numerically down. That's how strong it is. The overwhelming sense as you go 1, 2, 3 is that you're actually going down. We have a simile. Suppose in a lotus pond there were blue, white, or red lotuses that have been born in the water, grow in the water, and never rise up above the water, but flourish immersed in the water. From their tips to their roots, they would be drenched deep, saturated, and suffused with water, so there would be no part of those lotuses not suffused with water. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by this happiness. Okay, so we have a lotus pond, and we have lotuses coming out of mud, but staying below the surface of the water. They're not waving in the breeze, they're not bobbing up and down with the water. They're underwater, completely permeated with water. This also is a very good simile. In the third jhana, there's a sense of isolation, sort of like you've just gone underwater a little bit. And it's very still, without the piti there. You're just content, and the contentment just goes on forever, and there's no sense of it coming and going, upwelling, or anything like that. It's just a very steady sense of contentment, a very still state, because the PT's gone away. Once again, you want to learn to maintain this for 10 to 15 minutes. First, you want to learn to get in. Then you want to learn to sustain it. Then you want to learn to spread it. And then, hang out there for 10 to 15 minutes. After which, it's possible to move on to the fourth jhana. Further, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and grief, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, which is neither pleasant nor painful, and contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. One sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. Okay, so the abandoning of pleasure and pain and the previous passing away of joy and grief. This does not mean that there was pain or grief in any of the jhanas. This is being said to point to a very neutral mind state, a very equanimous mind state. No pleasure, no pain, no joy, no grief. There certainly was joy in the first two jhanas, and there's pleasure in the first three. And so to move to the fourth jhana, you want to move beyond the pleasure of the third jhana. In the first jhana, you might have a big grin with your teeth showing. And in the second, a nice big smile, maybe no teeth. In the third jhana, you've got maybe the wispy Buddha smile. Yeah, it's content. It's nice. But it's still pleasant. To move to the fourth jhana, let go of the pleasantness that you're experiencing in the third jhana. I find that I can put my attention on that little wispy smile when I'm in the third jhana and then relax all the muscles in my face. And when I do, there's a sense of things starting to sink down, dropping down, 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 just going further down. If I can stay focused on that sense of things dropping down, eventually it will settle into a place of quiet stillness. That's the fourth jhana. Ayakema said that being in the third jhana is like being just inside the mouth of a well. You're a little bit isolated from the world around you. To get to the fourth jhana, let go and drop down the well. Now, the dropping down is not like a free fall. It's more like drifting down. Perhaps the image of drifting down to the bottom of a swimming pool. At the third jhana, you're just under the surface of the water, and then you drift down to the bottom. Another possible image, in the third jhana, you're in the mouth of a cave, and the fourth jhana, you go deep, deep down inside the cave. Most people get this sense of things going down. Just stay with that sense of things going down until it settles, and then your object of attention becomes quiet stillness. The fourth jhana is spoken of as the jhana of equanimity, but if I tell you focus on equanimity, that might be a little nebulous. But if I tell you focus on quiet stillness, you will be focused on equanimity, because that's all that's down there. So your target is the quiet stillness. It says that in the fourth jhana, it's neither pleasant nor painful and contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. So the mindfulness that you are generating when you're in this fourth jhana is mindfulness that's very even, very balanced, very imperturbable, which will be quite useful we're doing insight practice when you come out. While you're in it, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by a pure, bright mind. When I first heard this pure, bright mind, it was like, what? Because my experience was that when I was down at the bottom of that well, focused on the quiet stillness. It was dark. Bright was not a word that occurred to me. Pure, yeah, because it was so quiet and still, it was very pure, but I didn't get the bright. So I asked Ayakema, and she said, no, it's fine. It's okay if it's dark. And so I didn't know what that was about. There is a simile, though. Suppose a man were to be sitting covered from the head down by a white cloth, so there would be no part of his entire body not suffused by the white cloth. In the same way, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by a pure, bright mind. Okay, I got the picture. It's a guy with a white sheet completely covering him, right? And so he's kind of isolated from the world around him. But why a white sheet? I mean, when I'm in there, it's dark. It's black. So what's going on with this bright and white? Well, I had no idea. I had learned the fourth jhana in 1990. And in 2006, I went to the Forest Refuge to spend a month with the Venerable Pal Auk, who's a jhana master from southern Burma. Now, he doesn't teach the jhanas as found in the suttas. He teaches what's found in the Visuddhimagga. And basically, what he gave us as meditation instruction was follow the breath of the nostrils and count the gaps between the out and the in. Up to 8. If you get to 8, go back to 1. If you get lost, go back to 1. And then we were to let him know when we could count for a half an hour without getting distracted, which, yeah, I was able to do fairly soon. So at the next interview, I told him, he said, okay, good, after half an hour, drop the counting and just stay with the breath until the nimitta appears. Now, a nimitta is a circle of light, and the Visuddhimagga makes a great big deal about you got to get this circle of light in order to enter a jhana. The word nimitta does appear in the suttas, but only as a sign. Like, if your stomach is growling, it's a sign you're hungry. Nimitta doesn't appear in conjunction with the description of the jhanas, ever. But 800, 900 years later, yeah, they've changed what their idea of jhanas are, and you got to get this nimitta. So the way to get the nimitta is you just follow your breath until the nimitta shows up. Like he said, sit for 3 or 4 hours. Okay. So I'm sitting in my room. I got a reasonably comfortable chair. When it got bad, I'd slide over to the bed and meditate lying down, maybe slide back into the chair. So yeah, I could go for quite a long time. Wasn't getting any nimitta though. What did start happening after an hour or so, I would get this most violent PT. I was shaking. Well, I was shaking so much, I was a little worried my head was going to pop off. Right? And so the next interview, I go to Pal Auk, and I describe what was happening. I didn't use the word PT. I just described the physical experience. And he said to me, that is gross PT. Do not let that happen. Okay. Well, I bring the PT on by smiling. I guess I shouldn't smile when I meditate. So I'd count for half an hour, very solemn, stop the counting and make sure I stayed very solemn. If I messed up and got distracted into some happy thought, nah, here comes the gross PT. All right, so keep a nice, solemn expression and the gross PT wouldn't show up. And I could just, you know, sit there following my breath, basically hanging out at what I'm calling access concentration for, 3 or 4 hours. Never got to his nimitta during that retreat. But sometimes, after I'd done what he told me to do for 3 or 4 hours, I would smile. And I'd get this huge hit of PT, you know, pop your head off type shaking. And after 10 seconds or so, it would fade away, And I'd have this huge grin on my face, and I would be so happy. It was very clearly second jhana. And the PT would come back from time to time. It wouldn't be as strong as that first one, but it would, you know, I'd be sitting there grinning with a break-your-face smile, and then here comes the PT, and then it would go away. And yeah, I'm just sitting there. It's like, wow, this is a really stable second jhana. My mind wasn't going anywhere. And as for drench, steep, saturate, and suffuse, I didn't need to do that. It was like I'd been picked up and dumped in a whole vat of sukha. It was just out to here. And I was just radiantly happy. And so after, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, it was like, well, this is pretty good. I wonder what the third jhana's like. Couldn't get there. I was just... Oh, the grin wouldn't go down. I couldn't get it to go towards contentment. And whenever I tried, the PT would come back. It's just like I'm stuck in the second jhana. Okay, well, it's not a bad place to be stuck. And so I hung out for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And then there was a sense of things just sort of going over the edge. And there was a calming down. And joy, the happiness, turned into contentment. And now I'm locked into the third jhana. And there's no more PT coming back. And it was, yeah, it was really profound. Both the second and third jhanas were far deeper experiences than I had ever experienced before. Of course, I just spent 3 hours in access concentration. That might have something to do with it. So I'm hanging out in the third jhana, and it's like, well, let's see what the fourth jhana's like. Nope. Just could not wipe that smile off my face. It was just so contented, right? So I'm stuck there and I have to hang out. And then at some point it just feels like it goes over the edge. And there's that sense of dropping down. And I just go with the sense of dropping down. And eventually it settles into this quiet stillness. Only this time it was not dark. It was bright white. It was just like if I went and sat in the middle of an open field on a sunny day with a sheet over my head, with my eyes open. Exactly matching the simile. Which told me very clearly that the Buddha and his monks and nuns were not doing jhanas at the same level I had been doing it. They were getting a much deeper level of concentration by the time they got to the fourth jhana. And therefore, the simile would make sense. Now, on this retreat, unless you're willing to spend 3 hours in access concentration, you're probably not going to get to the fourth jhana with a bright white field. Maybe you would if you spend an hour in access concentration before triggering the first jhana. You could play with it and see, but get good at the first jhana at whatever level of concentration. Learn 1, 2, 3, 4 at whatever level of concentration you can muster on this retreat. And when you're really skilled at it, then you can play around at staying longer in access concentration and see if you can generate this bright white field. I find for myself it only shows up when I'm on retreat. And generally only when I'm on a longer retreat. If I do a shorter retreat, it's still dark down there. But if I'm on a longer retreat and really get settled in and then am willing to put in the time to let the access concentration build, then I can get back to the fourth jhana as a bright white field. When one's mind is thus concentrated, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, one directs and inclines it to knowing and seeing. One understands thus, this is my body, having material form, composed of the four primary elements, originating from mother and father, built up out of rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion. And this is my consciousness, supported by it and bound up with it. The purpose of the jhanas is to generate a mind that is concentrated, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, which one directs and inclines to knowing and seeing. The mind that is concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, etc., is the kind of mind that can do insight practice much more efficiently. So one comes out of the fourth jhana by starting to do an insight practice. If, for example, your insight practice is the five daily recollections, you're in the fourth jhana, it's quiet, it's still, there's nothing going on. When you want to begin your insight practice, you simply say to yourself, I am of the nature to grow old. I've not gotten beyond aging. And just start doing the practice. That's inclining and directing your mind towards knowing and seeing. And knowing and seeing what? This is my body, having material form, composed of the four great elements, originating from mother and father, built up out of rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing to dissolution and dispersion. So an investigation of the body and its attributes. And this is my consciousness, supported by it and bound up with it. Vijnana, consciousness here, is being used as a synonym for mind. So basically, with your concentrated mind, you are to direct and incline it to knowing and seeing with regard to this body and mind. You are to investigate body and mind. Now, we talked about the Satipatthana Sutta, the four establishments of mindfulness. First establishment is body. Second establishment, Vedana, that's mind. Third establishment, mind state, mind. And fourth establishment, phenomena, and the phenomena are mostly mental phenomena that are described with respect to the teachings. That's mind. So the jhanas are a warm-up exercise for insight practice. They prepare your mind so that you will experience more profound and deeper insights. Becoming fully awakened is a difficult task. It's probably more difficult than cutting this table in two with a butter knife. I mean, you could get a butter knife, dull old butter knife, and start cutting. And if you were persistent enough, you could cut the table in two. But you know what? It'd go a lot faster if you got a whetstone and started sharpening up that butter knife, put an edge on it. And now when you start cutting, you'll cut a lot faster. It'll get dull, you can sharpen it again and cut through. In fact, you'll go so much faster that you'll make up all the time you wasted with the sharpening, right? So it's the same thing with the jhanas. You sharpen your mind and then you wield your sharp mind to gain insight into the nature of reality. In the Tibetan tradition, the bodhisattva of wisdom is Manjushri. And he's often depicted as having a sword which he uses to cut through the bonds of ignorance. Jhana practice is simply sharpening Manjushri's sword. You haven't cut any bonds of ignorance yet. You've got to go out and wield a sword. That's your insight practice. And you certainly don't want to just sharpen your sword. If that's all you do, well, eventually you got no sword left and you didn't cut any bonds of ignorance. So the method of using the jhanas is to get yourself supremely concentrated by stepping through these jhanas. And then with your mind that's thus concentrated, clear, sharp, etc., turn it to doing an insight practice and cut through the bonds of ignorance. Any questions?
Is there use in turning to insight practice if you've only gotten partially through the jhanas?
There are several suttas that indicate that it can be very beneficial to do insight practice after any jhana. In fact, there's one sutta that says that coming out of the first jhana, you can become fully awakened. Right? Going to be tricky, right? But yeah, the first jhana is not so helpful because of all the agitation due to the piti. But most people who learn the first jhana, given sufficient time, learn the second one and probably the third one fairly easily. Those transitions are not that difficult. Coming out of the third jhana, yeah, you're in a much better space for doing insight practice. And particularly coming out of the fourth jhana and higher, you're in a very good space. But yeah, coming out of any of the jhanas. In fact, if you didn't even get to the jhanas, but you got to access concentration, that's going to be more beneficial than if you just sit down and start doing insight practice right off. That will give you somewhat of a sharper mind.
This is just curiosity, but as you found the Pao-Ak jhanas sort of supercharged in a way you hadn't experienced, when you turned your imperturbable mind to insight practice, did you notice the supercharging of that too?
No. I was tired. Okay, I was mentally tired after meditating for 3 or 4 hours and then spending another half hour plus moving through the jhanas. And then when I turned my mind to the insight practice, it was like, I don't want to sit here anymore. Okay, so I'd passed the point of, most efficient practice. So what I found later, though, first off, I should say these were not Pao-Ak's jhanas, okay? This was still Sutta jhanas. They just were a lot better because I was using Pao-Ak's method, but not getting to his jhanas.
Got it, okay.
On a later retreat, I had 4 months with him, and I did get to his first jhana one time. But I also found that I would sit there and I was getting the real nimitta and everything, but not getting back to his first jhana. And I'd be meditating away and lose it, slide into the second jhana, or the third, or the fourth. And those states were, again, very profound, like I'd had on the previous retreat. And there was more insight available then coming out because I wasn't so wiped out. Maybe it'd take me an hour to get the nimitta really well established and so forth, and then a half an hour later I'd slip off into the second jhana. I was like, well, okay. So jhana 2, 3, 4, and then do some insight practice. And so there was a difference there. But I wouldn't say a profound difference, but I came back from that retreat. Well, it was 9.5 months long. That may have had something to do with it. Definitely different, and it stuck. So it's hard to say. Yeah, I didn't get, blinding insights during that time, but it definitely had a long-term effect on me. So.
I was wondering if you could compare the contentment of the third jhana with whatever is the affective component of access concentration once we are free from the hindrances and present to the object of meditation.
Most people find that in access concentration it's nice, but the quality of contentment in the third is just like, oh, wow. It's so much stronger. So there may be some hint of contentment in access concentration, but compared to the third is a much more profound state. And because that's what you're focused on, it's all-encompassing, whereas in access you're still following the breath or doing your metta meditation or whatever. So it's just a portion of the experience, whereas in three it's stronger and all-pervasive. Digha Nikaya number 2, the Samanyapala Sutta, the Discourse on the Fruits of the Spiritual Life, the same one I was using last night.
Lee, I shouldn't even thought about this, but I wonder if you have any ideas why the jhanas, which are moving towards deep stillness, start with such a radical other end of stillness with PT. Why not? Why don't the jhanas start you know, later, like the third jhana. It should be, seem like a more natural place.
Yeah, how come you don't just, you know, get quiet on the breath and you just keep gently going down? Yeah. Why this big up and then down? The up of the piti brings the sukha, right? And so the purpose of the up is to get the piti going so that you can get the sukha going. In other words, you're going to get a better hit of sukha if you get it in conjunction with the piti. My guess is that what's going on is you're hyperstimulating your nucleus accumbens, which is the reward center in the center of the brain, and causing it to pump out dopamine, which turns into norepinephrine, and that's the PT. And it also pumps out opioids, which is the sukha. All right, so now you've gotten hyper. You move to the second to get things calmed down. But in so doing, you've increased the concentration better than if you'd just gone straight into the second. All right, because the experience of being in one does generate more concentration. And then as you move from the second into the third, you sort of get the dopamine and norepinephrine out of the way, and now you've just got sukha at a lower level. And then finally that's out of the way, leaving you in a... well, I actually say in the book, it's like a post-orgasmic high, right? You get to a space you can't get to without having been at this high spot and then let all the energy out of it. And so that seems to be what's going on here. It is possible to go directly into the fourth jhana, just like it is possible to start your car in fourth gear. But it's not going real well at first. What you need to get it to go real well if you start in fourth gear is a downhill slope. Well, the downhill slope is concentration. So sometimes, as I said, I'd be working, trying to get back to Powok's first jhana, and I would just slide off into the fourth jhana. And it was a nice, deep, bright white fourth jhana because the concentration was quite deep, and I would slide into it. But in general, I found, you know, to have something I can carry around with me and actually use outside of a retreat setting or on a 10-day retreat instead of a 9-month retreat, it's much easier to get into the first, get the energy up, and then bring it down and leave me in that post-PT high space. That's my best guess as to what's going on.
Do you think there could also be a relationship between the need for energy in those deep states of concentration? Because concentration, if you have so much, right, you just collapse. So it's like the PT almost, even though it's not there, it's sort of like it's set you up to carry you.
Yeah, I think that may be part of it as well. In the seven factors of awakening, which we talk about, there's mindfulness, investigation, energy, which leads to PT, which, when the PT stopped, leads to tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So, the PT will energize you so that you have a brighter mind, I suppose, as you're moving into these deeper states where perhaps if you just moved into them, you just go to sleep.
Well, so, with the five spiritual faculties.
Right.
They say energy.
Energy and concentration need to be balanced. So, yeah. If you're getting a big hit of concentration, it's helpful to have the big hit of energy, and PT is certainly that big hit. Yeah. So I think maybe there's multiple things going on here. Other questions?
And what would you say to people who have jhana envy?
Don't have any expectations. Yeah, I mean, the worst thing about teaching jhanas is to prevent outbreaks of comparing mind. Usually at this point on the retreat, I say, Yeah, feel free to ask any questions you want, but don't ask any questions about the jhanas that we give any hint at all that you've actually experienced them. Mm-hmm. And if you can't figure out how to ask a question like that, then leave me a note on the board and I'll figure out how to do it. But yeah, it does no good to wish that you were in somebody else's space. You just have to work with what your space is. I would very much like to have kicked the game-winning field goal as time expired in the Super Bowl and be that hero. Mm-hmm. But, you know, since I couldn't kick a football worth diddly squat to begin with, it's just not going to happen. So pointless for me to envy people that can do that. And so I should work with the talents that I have. Some people find the jhanas very easy. Some people find that they can get there if they work on it. Some people find that, yeah, they get there rarely. And some people find, yeah, it's just not happening for them. We've all got different talents. If your talent is concentration, here's a way you can use that talent on the spiritual path. If that's not your talent, maybe you can play with it some. Or maybe there's something else you can do. We all have various talents. I'm actually one of the world's worst multitaskers. Right? You put me in a situation where I have to multitask, I'm pathetic. One of my friends showed me a card game, and it's a real multitasking card game. You've got to watch what's going on in the board in front of you, and you've got to be drawing your cards and, you know, the whole thing. I was always the worst person. The little 8-year-old kids were beating me terribly. You know, I don't have that. So if there was a part of the spiritual path that required multitasking, I'd have to say, yep, that's not going to work. So it's a matter of finding what your talents are and putting them to use on the path. For some people, the jhanas come easy. For some, they don't.
And if you're drawn to it because concentration is what you're least good at, mm-hmm. and you want something to help you to learn how to concentrate,
then trying to do this practice will help you with your concentration, whether you experience these states or not. Almost everybody can get to access concentration. Okay, that's just a matter of persistently showing up and really giving yourself to the practice and not indulging in your distractions and so forth. That getting to access concentration will certainly help you with your concentration outside of the spiritual path as well as on the spiritual path. So yeah, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. Play with it and see how it unfolds. See if it's something that's useful for you. And be patient. I mean, it's only day 3. I'm just now expecting people to arrive. Maybe tomorrow they get here, right? And so after you arrive, it's still going to take a while before it starts happening. The first retreat I taught, there was one student who got into the first jhana for the first time in the very last sitting. He had just been patiently working on it. He didn't give up, and it happened. And before the year was out, he did some more retreats, and he'd learned all 8 jhanas. But it took him a long time to get there. So, yeah, you just have to keep working with it with no expectations. Just as best you can, follow the instructions and see how it unfolds.
The different kinds of piti that you listed, momentary, fleeting, or showering and stuff.
Right.
If piti starts to come on and then goes away.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to do? Is there anything in particular we should do in response to that?
Keep doing what you were doing that brought it on and see if it'll come back and stick around. This is a pretty common thing. You know, you got some degree of concentration and the PT comes and it just sort of faded out. All right? There can be several reasons for it to fade out. One, you didn't have sufficient concentration. And so, yeah, just keep concentrating till it gets deeper and then maybe it won't fade out. Two, you got excited that it was coming. Your excitement knocked you out of it. This is really common. three, it's coming, and it's a little weird, and you're not quite comfortable with this going on, and that'll knock you out of it. So any of these are possible. So yeah, just drop back into whatever you were doing when it came on, and continue doing that with the hopes it'll come back. A lot of people get the minor PT with the rocking. Okay, they sit down, they're following their breath, and then they just notice they're starting to rock. Okay, so they're beginning to get a little bit of it there in the background. But there's nothing you can do with that. It's just a sign that things are going in the right direction. And then a little later, yeah, oh, here comes the, oh, it went away. Right, and this happens to a fair number of people. Yeah, just keep practicing. And then you might get some showering where it's coming and going. Just keep practicing. Hopefully it'll show up as sustained PT at some point.
Practicing, you go back to the stage you were at previous, or do you ever go back to the beginning? Do you start over again, like the aid, and then dropping the aid, and if you've lost?
I would say that you probably wouldn't go back to the aid in that sitting. Okay, so if you started out, say, counting, and you counted for a while, you dropped the counting. You work along, you're with the pleasant sensation, and you get distracted, and the pleasant sensation is gone. Just go back to the breathing, not back to the aid. So as far, you would just go back, if there's no pleasant sensation to go back to the breathing. If the PT comes along while you're on the pleasant sensation but fades out, just stay with the pleasant sensation. Yeah, so you don't want to go far back, unless that's all you can go back to. But if it's the breath, you can always get back to the breath without using the aid. So use the aid at the beginning. Now, at the end, you might think, well, I didn't get all that concentrated. Maybe the next sitting I'll use the aid for a longer period of time. But going back to the aid usually is just counterproductive.
Remind me, at what point do you shift to the pleasant sensation?
After you've been at access concentration for 5 to 10 to 15 minutes. Okay, so you get to access where you're not getting distracted. Stay there for a while.
Even though it feels good.
Yeah, just, yeah, enjoy being there. Hang out. If the pleasant sensation comes along before that, great. You'll know right where to go after you've got the access. The most common problem that people encounter trying to learn the jhanas is jumping too soon. In other words, they're meditating along, and here's a pleasant sensation, let me go for it, but they don't have the concentration. It's more important to build the concentration. If the pleasant sensation comes along, it'll probably still be there once the concentration's built, and then you turn to it and it'll go much better.
An extension of that, when the pleasant sensation comes, there's a transfer from the breath to the sensation. If that sensation is mobile, it can be challenging, and probably plus some Pavlovian desire to hang on to the breath.
Yeah. What you have to do is get your mind focused on enjoying pleasantness. All right? So that's the idea. If the pleasant sensation's moving around, can you just sort of get a sense of enjoying the area of where it is? That's where you're aimed at. But it's more about enjoying the pleasantness than being focused in a specific location. It's not the location, it's not the strength, it's not the how long it's been there or whether it's increasing or decreasing. It's the fact that it's pleasant. So rather than chasing after the pleasant sensation, can you quietly experience the pleasant sensation wherever it happens to be? And that may be sort of in a broader area, rather than locked into a single spot like you were doing with the breathing.
In the afternoon, I tend to be well concentrated in the morning, but then in the afternoon, all the body's aching, and the neck, and the back, so then...
Yeah. Most people find that there's some part of the day that goes much better for them, right? The most commonly reported peak time is before breakfast. That's about half the people. And then the rest of the day is spread out, you know, as to some people's late evening, some people it's after lunch. When it's your peak time, give it your best shot. When it's past your peak time, or your peak time hasn't arise, yeah, work with it as best you can. Sometimes it's pretty obvious you're not going to get well concentrated. Get what concentration you can, forget about the jhanas, do some insight practice then after you've gotten as much concentration as you can. Tomorrow I'll show the body scan. And I tell people, do the body scan at the time that is not your peak time. So for you it would be, yeah, in the afternoon do a body scan, which is something that is useful and can help with the concentration, particularly when it's not your peak time. So, but there are other practices you could do, you know, whatever you think of as standard Vipassana. But try and get some degree of concentration each time. What I found is that, yeah, it's not my peak time, but if I'll at least work on some concentration, well, not before breakfast, because then I'll go back to sleep, but after breakfast, you know, just work some concentration. And even if I don't get to the jhanas, then start doing my insight practice. And then in the afternoon, which is my peak time, all right, really crank it up now and hopefully get the jhanas and then post-jhana insight practice.
But it seems that remaining seated really increases the aversion and then
even... Yeah. Yeah, so sit for 40 minutes, go walk for an hour. I mean, you can do stuff like that. Yeah. It's a matter of finding your rhythm in the afternoon as to what works for you. Yeah.
Maybe a little off topic. Does the Buddha ever talk about the support of other beings in achieving these states? Because I've had experiences doing insight dialogue with somebody else where I could access PT and Supa and all this stuff in relationship.
Uh-huh.
And it felt like it was a relational thing.
Right. Yeah, there's no mention of anything like that. What I read you tonight was almost everything you find in the suttas. Not the every place you find it, but every place you find the jhanas, what you find is this, or part of what's there. It maybe doesn't have the simile. So there's just not a lot of detail there. There's one sutta where it points out what the object is in each jhana, and that's about it. You know, and I mentioned what the object is for each jhana. So, yeah, what you heard is all there is. But what you describe, yeah, I can see where that happens. When you're in insight dialogue, for example, with someone, you could get the PT and Sukha arising, but you wouldn't have the concentration level, really, I think, to call it a jhana. So it's just the experience of PT and Sukha. It could be, though, that you're in the dialogue with somebody, you get the PT and Sukha going, and then both of you close your eyes, you stay focused on the PT and Sukha, and then the concentration gets deep enough to take you into the jhana. But while you're talking with someone, you're not going to have that deep a concentration.
Yeah, I experienced it more in that latter, what you just described, where we weren't speaking, but we were
right.
In a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the sukha that mentions the objects in each jhana?
It's Digha Nikaya number 9, the Potapada Sutta. The translation by Maurice Walsh is a little bit screwed up. He left out the objects for... There's only 7 jhanas mentioned there, and I think it's 5 and 6 he left out the objects. But you look in the Pali, they're all there. So, yeah, well, you can figure out what they are. Just know to insert them, because it's pretty clear that for the 5th jhana, it's infinite space, because that's the name of the 5th jhana, etc. The jhanas. In fact, when you get through this course, you will have heard, you know, half the book. Yeah.
You mentioned that you had some pretty intense PT when you were at the monk retreat. I'm just imagining all of us sitting together in here. How do you put a lid on it so that it's not disturbing?
If it's too much, take a deep breath. Really let the energy out, and that'll put a lid on it.
Okay, and that won't throw you off.
If that PT comes with some sukha, then focus on the sukha. So in other words, you got just a brief first jhana, okay, but it was too intense, and so you move on to the second by focusing on the sukha. Yeah, it's like, okay, I'm in the first jhana, that's enough, let's move on, right? Generally, when I'm on retreat and things are going well, I'm only going to spend about 10 to 30 seconds in the first jhana, okay? Because I know how to crank it up really, really, really strong, and it's like, okay, that's enough, let's move on. From time to time, I decide, okay, I'm not going to crank it up real strong this time, so I'm going to stay in it for 5 minutes. So I've done it enough. I know where the volume control is on the PT.
You just kind of set the intention.
Yeah, I just know what to do to make it get stronger and weaker. And no, I can't really lay it out there. It's a feel that I have after having played with it all these years. But yeah, I can make it strong, and then I can turn it down, and then I can bring it up. In fact, that's actually a very helpful thing when you first start getting into the first jhana. Get the PT as strong as you can, and then see, can you decrease it by, you know, pulling your attention away, and then bring it back up by putting your attention back on it. If you do that, you'll begin to figure out where the volume control is. Okay, the counting is you breathe in, you breathe out, and you count the gap, into the gap between the out and the next in. And you go up as high as 8. If you get to 8, you go back to 1. If you get lost, you go back to 1. You want to pay careful attention that you're counting in the gap and not the end of the out, because the first distraction seems to be that the number starts coming a little sooner towards the end of the out rather than actually in the gap. If you can just think of throwing it in the gap, you know, it's like you're playing putt-putt golf, and there's the windmill, and you got to throw the ball, strike the ball, so it goes when the gap is there between the blades of the windmill. And you're doing the same thing here. You're throwing the number in the gap between the out and the next in.
So you don't think about it before you get to the gap. Is that what you're saying?
Right. You're just paying attention to the tactile sensations of the breathing, and then there's the gap, you throw the number in.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say you get distracted, do you mean distracted by other thoughts, or you just don't catch the...
I find what's happening. I'm really paying attention to the in and the out. I'm getting it into the gap. And now I'm not paying quite as much attention, and the number is starting to come out before the gap gets there. So that's... I'm not paying attention like I was before. I'm getting a little sloppy, and that's what I mean by getting distracted. So I haven't gone away I haven't lost it yet, but I'm getting in that direction. And if I still keep counting the end, it'll go on automatic, and then I'll wander off. But if I'm really looking to get it in the gap, then I won't get distracted at all.
Are there disadvantages to going past 8?
If you go to 10, it's pretty automatic. Right? So, you know, you can go 1 3 5 7 8 9 10, 1 3 5 7 8 9 10 really easily. 8 is like a difficult place to stop, so you got to pay more attention. So it's advantageous just to go to 8. If you go to anything higher than that, you can just put it on automatic for a while. Actually, I found when I was working with Powell that 8 became automatic. So then on the odd-numbered days, I'd go to 7, and on the even-numbered days, I'd go to 8, right? And I still found that I could get automatic, you know, 1, 2, automatic, 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 and then I'd come back in around 6, right? And then I'd, you know, either stop at 7 or 8. So there is this whole automatic thing, and so stopping at 8 helps counteract that. If you want to see how long you can stay with it and count as high as you can, yeah, you can go a lot further with sort of, you know, automatic counting. And it's that trick of, yeah, you're really present and you do stop at 8 or 7. So it has an advantage.
Putting the number in there seems to take me away from the felt sensation of the breath. Are we staying with the felt
Yeah, and what I find in the gap, there's almost no sensation. So it's going out, there's the gap, and I throw the number in. And now here comes the in-breath, and this is a very definite sensation there, so now I'm back to the sensation. So,
do you have to put the number in there?
What?
Do you have to put the number in there?
Well, that's what I found worked best. Right? I mean, Ayakema said, as you breathe in, you count one. As you breathe out, you count two. And I played with that, and it wasn't very interesting. And I abandoned it right away. It's like, nah, I got too many numbers in my life. Once I started playing with Powwalks, yeah, it was like, oh, this is good. This is really good. This is generating some, this is far superior to what I'd done before. So that's why I'm recommending that.
But I think when I heard your question, you were asking maybe what's the fourth technique or skill?
The beginning, middle, end, gap, beginning, middle, end, gap. It's the
eight. The other, just knowing breath, right? Or is that?
Well, all right, the first one is counting. The second one is the visualization. Right. The third is the words. And the fourth is really intending to catch each of those points. Okay? Which is different from just being there with the breathing.
Okay.
All right, you're really identifying this is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end, this is a gap. Whereas when I'm just following the breath, there's the in breath, there's the out breath, there's where the number goes. So
is the middle for you the actual middle, or is it everything between the beginning and the end?
Wow, this group really likes to get into the details.
Yeah. I've been working with that, though. I mean, I decided it's the whole thing.
It's more or less the middle.
Okay.
Right? It's more or less like I've got the first third, the middle third, the last third, but the thirds aren't really good. I mean, if I was cutting up a piece of pie, somebody might complain that they got too small a piece. Right? I'm not making a big deal about it. Just basically that's it. Yeah.
Somewhere I've read that people who are adept at all four jhanas sometimes go in reverse order.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why they would.
Yeah. In fact, when you're learning the jhanas, it's very helpful to learn them in forward and reverse. 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1. Or 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 2, 1. Okay? And as you go to a jhana from two different directions, you're seeing more of the essence of the jhana. You're not confusing the method of getting into the jhana with the essence of the jhana. For example, you go for a hike in the woods and you come to a clearing. And if you just always come to it from the same direction, you're not really paying that much attention. It's like, yeah, the trail comes in here, there's this clearing, I go out there. Right? But if you come at it from another direction, it's like, oh yeah, I've been here. I recognize this and I recognize that. Okay? And so you're doing the same thing. You're seeing the jhana from different directions, and therefore you're getting a better sense of what is the essence of that jhana. And so you can do that for all of them except, of course, the highest one that you know.
You said that was all that was in the suttas about the jhanas?
No. I said that the description I just read you is all that you find in all of the suttas about the jhanas. Or a subset of that.
I was thinking of those similes of going through the desert and finding the water.
That's not in the suttas.
Oh, it's not?
No, that's from the Visuddhimagga.
Okay, because I guess that's from Aya.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
And she says in the Visuddhimagga. Okay. And I found it in the Visuddhimagga. And there's a footnote to it in my book. Right. But that's, yeah. All there really is just what's here. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. They had an oral tradition. And so, one, this wasn't so that you could learn it. Right? If you needed to learn the jhanas, you went and studied with a jhana master and he taught you the jhanas. You know, it's like, you know, go do this and come back and tell me what happened. Right? And in the suttas, they're chanting this stuff to remember. And so all of the different things about the jhanas sort of converged into this one stock phrase, or these four stock phrases. They're called pericopes. And so when you're chanting a sutta and you get to the jhana part, all you have to do is remember this one thing. And so you chant this pericope. And when you finish that, then you know what the next pericope is, and you chant that. So you're chanting along and you come to the abandoning the hindrances. And so you chant what I read you yesterday. And when you finish chanting that, then the next thing you know is the jhanas, and so you chant the thing you've memorized. And it makes it much easier to remember huge volumes of material, because the jhanas get mentioned a lot, and everywhere it's mentioned, you just chant the same thing. Unfortunately, for us, a lot of detail got lost. So it goes.
Is axis concentration always has that white, bright light?
No. Some people always see the diffuse white light. Some people never see the diffuse white light. Some people see it sometimes and some people don't see it. The only real definitive way of knowing you're at axis concentration, you're fully with the object of meditation and not getting distracted. If there are thoughts, they're in the background. All the other stuff, including the breath getting shallow if you're doing breathing, the lights, everything else, may or may not show up.
And if you have a thought and you know you have a thought, but you're not carried away by the thought.
Yeah, then it's in the background. Yeah.
And is there a different quality to that white light, to the fourth jhana white light?
I found it much brighter in the fourth jhana. Okay, so you get a diffuse white light. So I've got my eyes closed and somebody's turning up the dimmer switch and it's getting brighter. That kind of bright light, white light in the access. And in the fourth jhana, it's like, well, having a white sheet over my head on a bright sunny day. It's bright white. It's much brighter. Okay? Okay, it's time for a short break, and then I'll do metta.